The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention. For the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated. No, we must have another room of people watching our court circuit. Court has two causes on its oral submission docket this morning. In the order that they will be presented, they are Mariner Financial Group and Joe Moore versus H.G. Bosley and Carol P. Bosley from Harris County, and Helena Chemical Company and Hyperformer Seed Company versus Kenneth Wilkins and Tom Wilkins, individually and doing business as Chapatel Farms and Corcione's 99 Properties. Garrett Gene Wilkins and Mark Wilkins, individually and doing business as Tabasco and the Wilkins Family Limited Partnership in Star County. In each of these causes, the court is allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. Petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of the arguments. The clerk is recording these arguments, and you may purchase a tape of the arguments for a nominal fee from the clerk's office. We are ready to hear from petitioners in Mariner versus Bosley.
May it please the court, Mr. McGraw is an argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please this honorable court, my name is Jim McGraw, and I'm the attorney for the petitioners in this case, whom I will refer to as Moore. It is Joe Moore and Mariner Financial Company. I will also refer to our side as we from time to time. I have reserved 5 minutes with the clerk for rebuttal. This case is an arbitrator bias case. It arises out of an arbitration conducted under the rules of the National Association of Securities Dealers, the NASD. My clients were the defendants in the case, the Bosleys, plaintiffs in the case. The case was heard by a three-arbitrator tribunal appointed by the NASD, and these were all neutral arbitrators. A public chairperson arbitrator, Bentley Nettles, and two other neutral arbitrators, one an industry expert and the other another neutral public arbitrator. The unanimous verdict and ruling of that arbitration panel was that the Bosleys take nothing. The Bosleys then filed a petition to vacate that ruling, that arbitration award, with the district court in Houston. And the district court granted a judgment confirming the arbitration award and denying the motion to vacate. The Bosleys appealed the case, and the Houston First Court of Appeals, in a split decision, rendered judgment reversing the case on the grounds of the evident partiality of the neutral arbitrator, to wit, Bentley Nettles. We ask the court here to reverse and render that case.
Mr. McGraw, let me ask you, is it your position that because the relationship at issue in this case involves a relationship between the arbitrator and the witness, that in fact the rules like TUCO should not apply in the arbitration context?
No, Justice Hankinson, that is not our contention.
Because I sensed from your brief that you were saying that that was a distinction that made a difference in whether or not TUCO should apply. And would you please explain whether I have misunderstood and we should just treat this as we would in any other context, looking at potential conflicts that affect an arbitrator, or whether there is some special consideration to be given because this is an arbitrator and a witness?
Your Honor, it is a distinction that makes a difference in the way that TUCO is applied, and that is this. The TUCO opinion acknowledged that waiver is an issue in the evident partiality cases. In this particular case, the twist in this case is not only is the relationship with a witness, but the relationship is with a witness for the complaining side.
Okay, so your point goes to the waiver argument. It does not go to the underlying evident partiality question. Is that right?
Well, it goes to the waiver issue,
okay, well,
but further, it goes to the access to information.
No,
well,
well,
the
duty
is entirely different between the two sides. Let's suppose I'm an arbitrator and one side has given me a campaign contribution. That's for whatever reason we don't have open reporting system. We'll pass by that, whether everybody has access. But they've done this favor for me that's not well known. I have no duty to disclose it to them, but I do have a duty to disclose it to the other side. Is that your position?
The rule, Your Honor, would be that you have that the arbitrator has a duty to disclose, period. The duty to disclose any, according to the Tuco case, as adopting the standard set forth in Commonwealth Codings, any relationship which to an objective third party could give the impression of partiality.
So you've got your duty has to be to disclose to all interested sides in the arbitration anything that's going to affect you based on an objective standard.
That is correct.
Well, then I'm not so sure how I understand what difference it makes with respect to the underlying issue about disclosure and the evident partiality rule with respect to the fact that this is a relationship between an arbitrator and a witness as opposed to an arbitrator and a party or a party's attorney.
From my standpoint, that makes no difference.
Okay, but that was my initial question was I had understood from your brief that you viewed that as a different circumstance that should give rise to different rules under those circumstances because there were different policy considerations implicated. So apparently I misunderstood. We should, in fact, evaluate from the front in terms of the evident partiality witness the same as we would if, in fact, the relationship were between we've got arbitrator and witness as compared to arbitrator and party or party's attorney.
That's correct, Your Honor. And
the reason
that my brief pointed that out is simply that the appellate court had seemed to key on that issue, that we're not talking about a party here, we're talking about a witness.
Thank you for clearing that up for me.
As long as we're talking about side issues, let me see the relevance you attribute to. A significant amount of time is put in the briefing as to who might have been in the better position, either Ms. Asmar or Mr. Nettles, to reveal the conflict of the evident partiality. Is that really important in our determination if we're looking at an objective standard?
Well, if you're looking at an objective standard, before you get to the objective standard is whether this fact, this relationship, would indicate possible bias.
Okay, so then do you agree that it might reasonably create an appearance of partiality to an objective observer?
Only under the standard that the arbitrator knew or reasonably should have known of the conflict.
But again, doesn't that get you to a subjective inquiry and you're balancing who should have known what as opposed to measuring it by what an objective observer would think?
Well, that's correct. But the disclosure requirement, and again, the disclosure requirement is a balance between trying to facilitate the efficiency of the arbitration proceeding with its fairness in light of the limited review and the like. And the balance, yes, that you could take the bright line approach that the appeals court took, and you could throw out every arbitration where someone can point to anything that any relationship that exists, you could throw out those arbitrations, but it is our contention before this court that skews that balance.
Well, but you have not contested that the particular relationship here is one that would pass objective muster. I mean, objectively, someone would we must find that objectively it would create the appearance of partiality that Ms. Asmar was a witness against this arbitrator. You're not contesting that.
On this appeal, I'm certainly not contesting that the fact of the relationship. I think there's no fact issue there.
Okay.
I think that the relationship occurred, and I think that a reasonable, objective third party could look at that relationship and say, yes, Mr. Nettles had a reason to dislike this person.
Okay, and so once we have that piece, where do we go from there is my question to you in terms of weighing who knew what when and who had the... It seems to me that if there's an objective standard, once you've answered that question, that's the end of the inquiry. Where would you go from there?
Well, before you get to the objective standard, we would have the court do what a number of other courts have done, and that is first of all, in order to... We have a disclosure test. And that is the test, the TUCO test is a disclosure test, and that was a test that was arrived at by analyzing the two lines of cases evolving from Commonwealth Codings, one being an actual bias test, conclusion of bias, and the other being an impression of bias. This court chose the impression of bias, the disclosure. And if the disclosure itself, if not made, with the objective look back, that establishes the bias. But the term disclosure in and of itself implies that the discloser, the person bound to disclose, must have some knowledge of what it is he is bound to disclose. And the TUCO case did not address that because it wasn't part of that case. It was clear from that case that
Mr. McBride. Maybe I misunderstood. I thought you said that you agreed that Mr. Nettles had a duty to disclose this relationship with the witness, that what your issue was waiver. Of waiver by the Bosleys to now complain about that failure to disclose. Am I wrong?
Well, I misspoke or spoke incompletely, because what I intended to say, what our position is yes, he had a duty to disclose this type of a relationship, which falls within the ambit of those which could cause an impression of bias, but only within a standard that makes some sense in the real world. And that is, he has to disclose that which he knew.
The witness was disclosed on the witness list. And so how can you argue, there's actual knowledge by Nettles may not have looked at the witness list, but from the record there's actual knowledge that he's aware of this witness. So
there's actual knowledge that he's aware of the witness. There is no evidence that he is aware of the relationship. Mm-hmm. And it is the relationship that must be disclosed. And what our contention is...
So Mariner brought forth evidence demonstrating that he did not know that this was a witness against him in the malpractice case.
No, Your Honor. The Bosleys brought forth no evidence that he knew or reasonably should have known of the relationship so that the nondisclosure would violate the TUCO standard.
But if that's the case, if we were to agree with your perspective on how this rule should be applied... This case is before us on summary judgment. The burden would not shift to the other side, even under your test, until you had actually offered proof that he didn't know. I mean, if there's nothing in the record, except for the fact that he was given the witness list as part, and that he signed something and sent it back to the NASD about what his conflicts were, and it did not include any disclosure about this witness, even under your test, even if we were to agree with it, how did you meet your burden on summary judgment? There would be no burden for them to come forward with evidence until you put on evidence that he didn't know.
Well, and I'm going to answer that by saying with an aside that there are some appellate cases which speak in terms of the standard for confirming an arbitration award on the one hand, and that when you do it in terms of a summary judgment procedure, that there is something referred to as it is, quote, filtered, end quote, through the summary judgment procedure. I don't understand what is meant by that.
But it doesn't change what Texas law requires in terms of a movement needing a burden to show entitlement to summary judgment.
Well, the movement in this case was reliant, all the movement has to do in an arbitration case is file the motion. And the reason for that is that under both the Texas and the federal statutes, the arbitration award must be confirmed unless the loser comes forward and pleads and proves that there is some impediment to the confirmation of the award.
Okay, so if they have pled that there's an impediment to confirmation, and that's evident partiality, so they have put that at issue by the pleadings in this proceeding to vacate the arbitration award.
That's correct.
Your position then is on summary judgment, you have absolutely no burden to go forward with the evidence and establish as a matter of law no evident partiality?
That's
no
correct.
Evident partiality?
Yes, Your Honor, because they came forward with...
no evidence motion?
Yes. The inescapable implication from the papers is that it was a no evidence motion.
Was it, you say the inescapable implication, was it a no evidence motion? Did you put the other side on notice that this was a no evidence motion under the rules? Or was this a pre-no evidence summary judgment motion under the pre-amendment of the rule?
Well, it was barely post-amendment. And
I haven't looked at the motion because it's not in your appendices. Did you put the other side on notice as required under the rule that this was a no evidence summary judgment motion?
In those terms, no. Okay. In terms of contesting that there was no evidence to support their case, and the answer is yes, they were put on notice.
Okay, so
they filed a challenge and asserted evident partiality. What did you respond? What did you do in opposition to that? Did you file a motion for summary judgment, or did you respond to their... You filed a motion to confirm. They responded evident partiality. Then what did you do?
Well, technically, Your Honor, the Bosleys filed a motion to vacate on the basis of evident partiality. Another defendant in this case, who has since gone in settlement, filed an answer and a counterclaim to confirm. My clients in the trial court filed a general denial, but joined in the motion for summary judgment. And then summary judgment was rendered on that.
On a record that didn't have any evidence, the movements did not put on any evidence.
Well, the movements were not, that's correct.
The movements put on no evidence, and you relied upon the other side to raise evidence.
Allow me to restate that. The movements offered evidence in the form of the arbitration award.
Okay, anything else?
No, but the arbitration award, according to both the state and the federal statute, must be confirmed unless there is pleading and proof of an impediment.
Well, but that's at a trial on the matter. The question is, how does summary judgment procedure overlay when you try to dispose of a case at this point in time?
Well, I cannot answer that.
Are there any Texas cases in the context of the procedural posture of this case that say that we handle a summary judgment motion any differently than we would in any other case?
No, Your Honor. They say that something about the filtering, which, as I say, I did not understand that, except to say that we're supposed to have a summary proceeding in the first place to confirm the arbitration award. And if you could just file the papers, Your Honor spoke of a trial in federal court at least, it's clear that the confirmation of the arbitration award is handled by the papers. If they could have filed the papers.
But let me ask you this, if there are fact issues related to evident partiality, you wouldn't try that?
Those would have to be determined by a fact finder.
Okay.
In federal court, they'd be determined by the court.
Let me get back to my question. I don't understand what the fact finding would be. My understanding is you can see that there is evident partiality here under the objective standard of the rule that we're talking about, subpart B. I think you've agreed that this was something that had to be revealed. And the question I believe you're going to second is, did the arbitrator know about it? And if they didn't know about it, they don't have to reveal it. Is that the summary judgment proof we're talking about here?
The summary judgment proof is that there was no disclosure in this case because there is no evidence in this record that he either knew or in the exercise of reasonable diligence should have known.
Where is the knew or should have known standard contained in NASD Rule 10312, which covers this agreement?
It is contained in the statement that the arbitrator should use, should make reasonable efforts.
I don't see that in here. What I'm looking at, which I believe is in the party's contract, says each arbitrator shall be required to disclose any circumstances that might preclude the arbitrator from rendering an objective and impartial determination.
Yes, but the contract references these other rules and regulations of NASD that govern NASD arbitrations, which are mentioned in the papers.
And okay, can you point to me in the papers where it says reasonably should have known about? I mean, this seems to me to be an absolute standard that if there is, it creates an appearance of partiality, which you've conceded on an objective basis, then it seems to me they have to disclose it whether they knew about it or not. There's a duty to disclose, and it's not a subjective, did they really know about it or not? It's one that has to be disclosed or it taints the process.
Your Honor, I will simply say that in my searching, there is no court in the United States that has held to a strict liability standard in that regard. The only cases that I have been able to find, that admittedly there are a dearth of those cases, the courts have assigned a constructive notice standard. In other words, the arbitrator is bound to disclose what he knew or should have known. Of course, under the actual bias standard, you're never going to have that because they're going to have to go and show actual bias anyway. But under our disclosure standard, the cases that have addressed this issue are new or should have known, such as the Schmitz versus Zilvetti case out of the Ninth Circuit. And I might add, I found a case here in this law library yesterday interpreting that case, which I would provide to the clerks, and I had it here with me. A case is very harsh.
All right, so let me get back to the Chief Justice's example. If one of the witnesses, or parties for that matter, have given a campaign contribution to one of the arbitrators, and it just has not come to the arbitrator's attention that that's happened at the time of the arbitration, that comes out later, under your analysis, because he didn't actually know about it at the time of the arbitration, it's okay.
If there is no evidence that he actually knew about it, and further no evidence that in conducting what would be a reasonable investigation as an arbitrator to determine potential conflicts, he would not have found it. If those two facts were present, then that case should not be vacated, and that, I contend, is the case that we have before this court now.
But then don't you have to have a jury trial on that standard in every single case? There has to be a fact-finding on whether they knew or should have known?
Well,
undermine the purpose of arbitration.
In some of the cases, in one of the cases, the person had been sued. The arbitrator had been suing. He'd been in litigation with the insurance companies on the other side. Well, you don't really need a jury trial there. And inexplicably, the man apparently testified.
Well, let me just say, in this case, you'd need a jury trial with a fact finding, wouldn't you? On knew or should have known.
Well, at this point, before this court, there is no evidence to submit to a jury because all you have on this record is the inference that the Bosleys asked the court to draw. And that inference is that because this relationship existed, he knew or should have known about it. And on that inference alone, that inference is no evidence because he reasonably may not have known about it.
Under any of these cases, is there a difference between something that, I mean, it's throughout your brief, if the party or their witness has equal or better access, that should reduce the duty on the arbitrator to disclose. But you haven't articulated that today, how that might fit into the calculus.
This court, in defining the disclosure requirement, what is disclosure? This court said it was equal, it was that the parties at the outset have access to all of the information that may bear on the bias or prejudice of an arbitrator in order to make a decision at the outset. In this particular case, the Bosleys had access to the information. The information was in the head of their expert witness.
Are you asserting that the Bosleys have a duty to investigate whether or not the witnesses they're hiring have a conflict with the neutral hearing officer?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that that's a prudent practice.
But in this case, you're saying Nettles does not have a duty to investigate whether or not the witnesses being used in the case he might have a bias against.
No, Your Honor. I believe that Mr. Nettles did have that duty. But on this record, there is no evidence that there, as to what it is Well, first of all, there's no evidence that he knew it, other than an inference that it is like the sun on the horizon, to go back to a recent opinion of this court. But there's no evidence other than that inference. And there's no evidence of what it was that this court should tell the arbitrators that they should do that would have disclosed this conflict.
It sounds like in this balancing thing that you want us to do, you're prepared to have us say that the Bosley should have known, but the arbitrator shouldn't have, even though there's also no evidence that the Bosley's witness actually knew until after the arbitration award had been entered. I mean, isn't that kind of, when you look at this particular case, you're saying we should attribute that they should have known, but we wouldn't attribute should have known to the arbitrator.
I would say that argument assumes that the court finds that what is in the, what could possibly be in the arbitrator's head, and with the knowledge that if that's the standard, then that standard should be imposed on the other side as well in determining what the access was to the information, whether the disclosure was made.
Well, there's a greater possibility of access to the Bosleys because a witness of theirs knew. I mean, to me it sounds like when you put this on the table and you want to charge the Bosleys with should have known because their witness, whose affidavit says, I didn't recall until I saw the file some period of time after the arbitration award had been entered, that we should attribute that to them sufficient to waive their claim of evident partiality and their right to challenge the arbitration award. But the very man who was the party to the legal malpractice suit that she testified against, we wouldn't in any way say that he should have known. I mean, how does your balancing test work under those circumstances?
If, as the appellate court said, that the waiver would be defined as know or have reason to know, and if that is going to be applied strictly to Mr. Bosley, that whether he remembered it or not, whether he ever knew it or not, that the circumstances indicate that he knew or had reason to know, if that standard is going to be applied, then we would urge that standard be applied to the other side as well.
Well, why did they lose if we apply both standards to each side? Even under your scenario, if we were to agree that that's what the law should be, why would they lose under those circumstances?
Let me phrase it this way and see if this is the answer. And that is, if each side has equal access to the information, there is no obligation on the part of the arbitrator to disclose it.
The way that I would change that is I would say that if the equal access is there, the disclosure requirement has been satisfied. That he has the duty. But if they have the equal access, and I'm not talking about, as some of the cases refer to, one party has constructive notice and the other party has actual knowledge, well, that's not equal access. I'm not talking about going down to the deed records or something like that. In this case, on the twist of this case, and that is it's a grudge case instead of the other kind of case, the equal access would equal a
disclosure. Did Mr.
Disclosure.
Nettles have actual knowledge in this case?
Mr.
Nettles have actual knowledge in this case?
I do not know that. And on this record,
I understand that you didn't put on any evidence one way or the other, but my question is, did he know?
I do not. I honestly have never, to my knowledge, spoken with Mr. Nettles.
Never asked him.
Pardon?
No one has ever asked him.
That is correct. And to me, that is to satisfy the simple requirement that the Supreme Court of the United States spoke about, the least somebody should do in this situation is ask the people on their own team, is there any reason, here are these folks up here that are going to be deciding our case, I can hire you or not for my expert witness, is there any reason that one of these folks might not like you? That is very simple.
How do we know this is an equal access case? I mean, this is not a situation that's been a public disclosure. This is based on what Asmar knew, based on what she says in the affidavit, I guess, that she found this in a file after the conclusion of the arbitration. And Nettles has not testified yet on this. So Judge Abbott has an appealing suggestion about equal access, but on this record, how do we know if this is such a case?
Well, on this record, and again, assuming that the burden of proof...
You're going back to burden of proof.
Yeah, assuming the burden of proof is on the Bosleys, which I believe is what the statute, both statutes, federal and state, require, then there's no evidence that he knew it, and there's no standard for determining whether he should have known it. And I would agree with Ms. Asbury.
You argue that there's no evidence that nobody could prove that somebody else knew something.
That's
all you can do it is by circumstantial evidence. And your argument requires us to believe that if Nettles had been sued for a professional malpractice claim and that an individual had appeared as the adverse witness to them on the expertise, that that is not some evidence that would support a finding that Nettles knew about the relationship of that witness to himself. You're asking the court to say that is no evidence that Nettles knew about that relationship.
On the facts of this record, where he was not at the deposition, they never saw each other.
But I've just recited the facts of this record. Nettles was sued from professional malpractice, and Aswar was the opposition witness to him on his expertise. And you're saying that is not evidence that Nettles knew about Aswar's relationship to Nettles.
Yes, one could draw that inference. One could draw that reasonable inference, but one could equally well draw the opposite inference, and that is that he did not know, and that is no evidence.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Luthen will present argument for respondents.
Tuco was a case where each side had its own arbitrator, and there was only one neutral. And that neutral's conduct was in question. Here, there's supposedly three neutrals, and the vote was 3-0. Isn't that a different situation?
Well, it's different, but the point is that the evident partiality changed the terms of the party's contract dramatically. It started out under a securities arbitration agreement and format where there are two public and one securities industry arbitrator. So it'd be 2-1 public, neutral. It ended up, instead of under the contract term of two public and one industry, one public, and one partial.
But so you still lost 3-0.
2-1.
If it had been a 2-1 vote, it seemed to me that just under our normal rules of what you prove, if it had been 2-1, that would be an easier burden than if you've lost 3-0.
It would be. But we ended up, I guess we're talking practicalities here. There's rarely a dissent. Generally, there's a consensus. And here there's consensus between an evidently partial arbitrator and an industry arbitrator. No one would want to come before this arbitrator. The facts couldn't get any worse in this case. This is not an arbitrator whose partner in a big law firm represented another company in a lawsuit 10 years ago and left the firm and all the other stuff that is in some of the cases. The facts don't get any worse than this if Tuco is to be applied and not changed. The point that I would like to make is that there, and the court may already realize that there are two contracts here in conflict. There is a contract that the arbitrator signed not to disclose that he settled a malpractice case for a large sum of money reasonably right after the Aswar deposition. That is in a sealed envelope in the vault of this court. There is also an arbitration agreement signed by the parties and an oath of the arbitrator signed by the arbitrator that incorporates rules that require disclosure, both using almost identical terms as Tuco and going further. The arbitrator complied with his signed agreement not to disclose. He did not comply.
To disclose what?
Not to disclose anything.
That
in
a public proceeding, a woman testified against him?
He didn't disclose anything about the settlement.
What's that got to do with the fact that she testified against him?
Well, She testified against him in the settlement, as would be shown by the documents.
So you give up if you settle it for $10?
I'd give up.
But if you settle it for $1,000, you might...
$10,000, I'd give up. The numbers are in the vault.
But we don't know that. Nobody knows that.
I don't know it. I don't know it, but I have an idea. Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that works against you, because the defense is it's a trivial failure to disclose. And since they've hidden all the information about the attorney could be there or not, it seems to me your argument that you face is either you had a duty to disclose this or you didn't. If you had a duty to disclose and failed to do so, then you win. It seems to me that's the way the posture of this case is, because he cannot rely on the triviality of the failure to disclose, because he objected to any evidence about the significance of Aswar's testimony, right?
I think that's correct.
Okay. So let's go to the equal access of information argument for just a minute. We have two people who know about, to the extent Nettles knew about Aswar. Aswar certainly knew about Nettles. I mean, Aswar did the testifying, Nettles was a party. So to argue that one or the other did not know it is an argument that cuts just as for Nettles as it does for Aswar.
I don't agree with that, John.
Well, seems to me it does. So, Aswar, so the question is, for me, why isn't this equal access? What keeps this from being an equal access?
That's exactly. Obviously, if we knew, there's the issue of waiver. I mean, I certainly don't want to leave without addressing that, even though it's the other side of the point. The arbitrator knew that he settled for a large sum right after, within a month, 2 months, 3 months, to prepare the agreement after the Aswar deposition. That's what your documents will show.
But the documents don't show he knew Aswar gave a deposition.
No, the documents, I doubt, say that.
Okay. So he was as much in the dark as was Aswar.
I can't agree with that, Your Honor.
Well, what evidence in the record contradicts that statement?
There isn't any, and that's the genius of, I think, the Tuco decision, is that we don't sue the arbitrator. We don't go into his mind.
Well, just for clarification purposes then, Nettles and Aswar had the exact same knowledge.
No, that I disagree
Why
strongly.
Why doesn't Aswar remember? If this was such
that's,
a big deal.
That's the next point, John.
Okay.
There's some indication, like she did not even tell her who the arbitrators were. She didn't know who they were. Yes, she knew the names. Of course, I would let my expert know the names and what she knew about them. She did not identify that he was the defendant until 67 days after the arbitration.
So why would he know? That's the question. If she didn't, why would he?
Okay. Well, he would know because she testified as to seven areas of malpractice, which in the deposition, which I could list, are very embarrassing to a good lawyer and very antagonizing to a bad lawyer.
Well, what difference does it make who knew what when? I can't get over that point. If it's an objective standard, isn't the purpose of the objective standard to avoid this sort of who knew what when analysis? And why don't we just look at what he's required to disclose rather than when or whether he might know it?
I agree, Your Honor, with that position.
If you're bound by the NASD rules, Rule 10.312b says that the arbitrator has to make a reasonable effort to inform himself of any conflict of interest. What did you plead that showed either he had actual knowledge or that he did not make a reasonable effort to inform himself? What did you put in you're trying to set aside an award, you've got a pretty heavy burden. What did you put in your pleadings that would get you over that rule?
I believe that where you have a party or an arbitrator who has entered into a confidential agreement, including a large payment, he would know why he settled, and it was because of a deposition that was given shortly before the settlement.
You don't have the evidence of that, and you didn't allege it.
Well, I think I did argue that.
What did you take his deposition? Did you
no.
make any effort to put on proof that would satisfy this rule? It would say that he either knew or he had not made a reasonable effort to.
No, because I didn't file a cross motion. I would do that if necessary in a cross motion for summary judgment.
Well, was there a motion for summary? Was it styled a motion for summary judgment?
There was a motion for summary judgment
the code
against.
Filed a, when you filed a motion to vacate.
Yes.
You filed a motion to vacate first.
Yes.
They filed a motion to confirm and attached to it a summary judgment.
Shortly after that, they filed a motion for summary judgment. I did not file a cross motion because I was denied evidence that is in the vault of this court, which I contend is abuse of discretion in denying discovery that's very relevant to the point of his knowledge.
Procedurally, I'm not sure I need to ask questions the other side. Procedurally, you filed a motion to vacate. What do you say you should do? What's your burden beyond just filing a motion to vacate?
Well, it's to prove
procedurally,
it.
How is that resolved?
I have to prove that there was evident partiality.
And let's say we say that we're going to follow the rules, and you have to prove that either he had actual knowledge or he failed to make a reasonable effort. Now, what did you allege or what proof did you offer that occurred?
I haven't proven it yet.
And are you continuing or denied discovery other than the settlement agreement? Were you denied the opportunity to take his deposition? What other facts would you need to make your case that this should be set aside?
I believe the burden, once it's established that there's been a nondisclosure that is not trivial, I believe that satisfies the burden, or at least it
but
shifts
the burden.
But do
you disagree that Rule 10.3.12b controls?
I don't think that's necessarily controlling. I think that you've got a fact question. That's all you've got is a fact question. You don't have a summary judgment question if we go to that. If we have to go to that, it's a fact question. And I believe that would be a fairly easy fact question.
I guess what she's asking is, it seems as though you have no pleadings or facts raised by you that raises a fact question. And she's trying to get out of you any hint that you may have raised a fact issue. And apparently, we haven't been able to hear that you have.
All right. Of course, I've pled generally, I think, to give notice of any of those issues. My response in the summary judgment is that the evidence, particularly that in the vault of this court, is sufficient for anyone to infer that he knew, and it wouldn't require any reasonable effort on his part because he knew. Now, he may not have known until he got to the arbitration and he found parties from out of town and witnesses from out of town there, and it would be embarrassing to then reveal a conflict and send everyone home, but he knew. I think that is a reasonable inference that I would have no problem taking to a finder of fact.
Is it fair to say that in every case you handle for your clients, that your clients know who all the witnesses are? You know who they are, but do your clients always know who all the witnesses are?
Well, certainly I ask them about them. I don't understand.
The point is that in that case, the client was, in the underlying case, the client was Nettles. And he may not have known who all the opposing witnesses were. And I know for a fact in previous litigation, clients don't know the names of all the expert witnesses who may be called to testify.
Okay. All right.
So the point being, very simply, that Nettles may not have known the name of the person who is giving expert testimony against him. And there hasn't been any effort on your part to raise a fact issue that, in fact, maybe he did know.
Okay, well, Justice Abbott, that doesn't apply to this case because he did know. He was sent a letter by not only the rule, but a letter with the list of the parties before the arbitration with this name on the first page.
No, but in the arbitration, this name was on the page, but what I'm saying is in the underlying case, the one that Nettles settled, there was no identification to him. There's no evidence that there was any identification to him that Asmar was a witness in that case.
Right. I couldn't get into that because I was denied it. It was all sealed. It was sealed, and I was not permitted to go into those facts.
But you didn't try to depose him or ask him, did you know? When did you know?
Well, no, after I was denied even the amount of the settlement or the settlement agreement itself, I did not ask the judge to deny me that right to.
But are you complaining about those rulings again?
Yes.
That's somewhere else?
That is an independent grounds for affirmance and remanding.
In this case.
Aren't those documents lost?
They're not lost. They're in the vault of this court.
So the Court of Appeals was wrong when he said?
The Court of Appeals thought they were lost. They've been sent here by the clerk of Court of Appeals. I had requested to ask if notice had been given to the court, the other side, and she said, all I do is send it with a note, and that's notice.
You told us in the brief they were lost. Have you notified us since then that they were
lost? No, I didn't, because I was told by the clerk that that's how notice is given to the Supreme Court, that they're filed, and the Supreme Court is given notice by the clerk of the Court of Appeals, and that's the way notice is given, not by the attorneys.
In Tuco, we had information about Mr. Beal's contacts that would not have been known by either party, or certainly would not have been known by the losing party, let me put it that way, would not have been known by the losing party or any of their witnesses. What is the legal effect of a distinction where, this, without getting into the fact whether it's equal knowledge or not, there is knowledge on the part of the losing party? What duty does that put on you? Does it lessen the duty of the argument?
It's not. I don't think it lessens the duty. I think that if there is proof of actual knowledge, there is waiver, pure and simple. I'm not going to try to get. I mean, that's waiver. With a note, and that's notice.
You told us in the brief they were lost. Have you notified us since then that they were?
No, I didn't, because I was told by the clerk that that's how notice is given to the Supreme Court, that they're filed, and the Supreme Court is given notice by the clerk of the Court of Appeals, and that's the way notice is given, not by the attorneys.
In Tuco, we had information about Mr. Beal's contacts that would not have been known by either party, or certainly would not have been known by the losing party, let me put it that way, would not have been known by the losing party or any of their witnesses. What is the legal effect of a distinction where, this, without getting into the fact whether it's equal knowledge or not, there is knowledge on the part of the losing party? What duty does that put on you? Does it lessen the duty of the
arbitrator? I don't think it lessens the duty. I think that if there is proof of actual knowledge, there is waiver, pure and simple. I'm not going to try to get. I mean, that's waiver.
Your argument, then the argument of inference would be that how is it that she couldn't possibly remember that she testified about against the guy that's sitting right up there in front of her, that he had committed malpractice in what you say are seven embarrassing lies?
Well, we have her affidavit, and unless we make an inference that she is lying or an inference against the non-moving party, her affidavit is, and is believable in my opinion, that she thought that she knew the arbitrator because she was also an NASD arbitrator, and that she had seen the name at NASD training conferences or had been assigned to a panel on which one of them had been struck as a by-peremptory challenge.
And if I'm inclined to agree with you on that, why isn't it equally likely that he didn't remember?
Well, because of the documents that I was denied, but this court has, he settled his malpractice suit for a large amount of money.
But I'm a little concerned. since we have the documents, I guess we can find them and look at them.
Yes, and I'm in a dispute.
And then we're going to have to make a decision based on what you argued today, whether the settlement was trivial or not.
Right.
And by deciding that, that's how we decide this case?
I think that goes a long way.
How can we do that? I didn't think we had the power to make factual decisions.
Well, triviality...
Well, you've already said $10 would be trivial. Even $10,000 would be trivial for...
Well, it probably wouldn't be, but I said I would give it up for $10,000.
Oh, you mean...
if the court will look at them, I don't think there will be any question. I don't know the exact amount. They are confidential. I do have some idea.
Well, I think that's clear from what you said. You have no idea, and we don't either until we open those documents. But even if we open them, so what? We can't decide based on what we see whether we agree or disagree with you because we can't make a factual decision.
It seems that at some point triviality...
It's your best argument. The Court of Appeals said we think there's a fact question to go back and try this case or do something more, and that that's what we ought to do here because they decided it correctly.
I think that's the only thing that could be done, even if I said the court at some point does have the power as a matter of law to decide triviality, a dollar or whatever.
Mr. Lupin, if the TUCO evidentiary, the TUCO evident partiality standard is applied here, and we've heard from your opponent that he agrees that he's not contesting the fact of the relationship and that that amounts to evident impartiality. How does that particular determination interplay with the NASD rules? There is the mandatory disclosure on the part of the arbitrator of relationships such as this, but underneath it, there is the duty to make reasonable inquiry by the arbitrator. In legally setting up the framework for this, how does the arbitration rules of the NASD that were incorporated into the party's contract interplay with the TUCO evident partiality standard and the application of it?
All right. I think TUCO avoids having to perhaps even depose the arbitrator. It's objective. Was there no disclosure of something that was non-trivial that creates an impression of evident partiality? Don't have to sue and don't have to depose him. If the contract interplays, and that is a defense, then it creates a fact issue that would require that he come in and show that he made a reasonable effort not to know who testified against him to cause the loss and the payment he made.
So basically the terms of the party's agreement could actually override the TUCO evident partiality standard? Is that ultimately how it plays out?
It's possible it could create a fact issue.
Okay.
And you said you wanted to discuss waiver. You know, that was the other side's issue. Do you think you've adequately discussed it?
I think the only thing that I, if I didn't say, was that, I did not mention one thing, and that is that to waive, unless there's proof by the moving party that there's actual knowledge and that my witness is lying, the statute is right. The statute says that the party does not have to catch the arbitrator's nondisclosure, that the witness does not have to catch the arbitrator's nondisclosure until 3 months after the award, and then it's barred, caught or not caught. Only 3 months. It was caught in this case because she was moving her office and found the Wilkins file, not the Nettles file, but the Wilkins file that contained the Nettles deposition. And she caught it within 67 days after the award. I think the statute determines to a large degree the issue of waiver, and then the fact issues, if they want to be proven by the other side, would determine the rest of any issue of waiver. In both cases, it should be remanded for either a summary judgment motion in accordance with the instructions of this court or for fact finding.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. McGraw, are you aware of any case law that would support your position that waiver can be based on a should-have-known standard on the part of the party to the arbitration as opposed to an actual knowledge standard?
Well, Your Honor, I would cite to the appellate court case in this case. That's what the...
Okay, separate and apart from the case that we're reviewing here, looking at, for example, federal jurisprudence, my understanding is that the federal jurisprudence looking at this issue has required actual knowledge before there's a waiver and that there's no support for your position that a should-have-known standard should be applied to recognizing waiver on the part of the party litigant to an arbitration proceeding. Is that your understanding of the law?
Yes, Your Honor. However, I would say that in this case...
Okay, the answer is that there's no support that you're aware of outside of what was said in this particular case that would support your position to apply a should-have-known standard for waiver purposes as opposed to an actual knowledge standard.
That is correct, but I would...
So you're asking us to break some new ground here.
Well, no, I would... if the court cannot get there on the waiver issue, the equal
on,
access...
On the waiver issue. I'm just talking the waiver issue.
Right.
We'd be the first ones to go down that road.
Well, the second, I guess, because the appellate court said that, but I
understand.
Not.
But putting that's this case, so as opposed to this case, we'd be the first court to do that, to your knowledge.
To my knowledge,
okay.
Yes. And again, I'm relying more on the equal access.
Why should we do that? Why should we step out and be the first court of last resort to say that?
Because the Tuco case speaks in terms of equal access. In this case, we are saying that the parties had equal access. I would urge the court to disregard the term waiver as that term is known at law in looking at this issue because it is...
How would you define waiver as it's being argued in this case if you want us to ignore existing law on how waiver is defined?
I would say that in the context of evident partiality, if there is equal access on the parts of the parties in the beginning, then the disclosure requirement has been satisfied. And another way to say that is, if the other party goes forward with that access and without accessing that access, they've waived it.
Okay, and you would agree that, is it correct that this record, reviewing what I've seen of it, this record has no evidence of actual knowledge on the part of the Bosleys or their witness until after the award was entered, and in fact, it establishes no actual knowledge.
That's correct, because
okay.
We would have to
okay.
accept Ms.
Right.
Asmore's affidavit as being true.
But you've also argued too that Mr. Nettles had no actual knowledge, so we have a case of nobody knew nothing
I've argued that there is no evidence in this record of Mr. Nettles' actual knowledge. I would say, Justice O'Neill, that the objective standard refers to the subject matter, what is to be determined to be evidence of partiality. The objective standard relates to that. But what we're dealing with here is how do you disclose? And again, the documents are a red herring. The documents will neither lend nor detract anything from this case.
Let me ask you a question. I'm concerned on this issue. The evidence in this case, and I think it's probably undisputed, that Nettles was the named party in a malpractice case. Aswar was the expert witness against Nettles in that case. Nettles had a letter that showed that Aswar was going to be a witness in this case, and your argument is that based on that evidence, that is no evidence that Nettles knew about Aswar, that did not know about the relationship with Aswar.
That is correct.
But when Bosley went to court to get the underlying documentation in that lawsuit, in an effort to come up with what was this testimony, what was this settlement, you objected?
No, Your Honor, we did not object. Frankly, I don't know that the lawyer who was subpoenaed, who ironically was the plaintiff's lawyer in the malpractice case, I believe Mr. Soloff, was subpoenaed to turn the documents over. He turned them over but said they're supposed to be kept confidential, Judge, so I'm turning them over, you know, and objecting.
And the judge refused to...
For some reason, unbeknownst to...
And you didn't ask the judge to disclose them. I mean, party had an obligation under settlement agreement to maintain the confidentiality, that going to the courthouse and saying, Judge, I can't turn it over, here it is. Was it your position then during the underlying lawsuit that it should have been disclosed to the Bosleys? Or did you take the position with the judge that it should not be disclosed?
We took no position.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument from the first case.